Hey, good morning, everybody. Still morning. We got a little bit of morning left. This is about 2:41, August 27th, second lecture, first week of school. We went all the way through chapter 1 last time. We're going to start with the chemistry chapter, and let's take a look at the schedule, and you can see that is chapter number 2. And I've got 3 lectures planned for chemistry. That's a lot of lectures, so I can have a lot of fun talking about chemistry, and you'll enjoy that, I'm sure. And especially if you've taken a chemistry class already, a college-level chemistry class, then you can help me teach this class, because you're going to be good. All right, so your first test, September 22nd. That's still 2.5 weeks away. But nonetheless, somebody reminded me in the parking lot as he was hopping on his motorcycle that he would have gotten a much better grade if he had figured out to use the exam figures, study the exam figures early on, not the night before the test. And I go, oh, yeah, okay, I maybe didn't make a big point to that. But there are exam figures in your study guides, and be sure that you're even more than familiar with them. You probably should be able to even draw some of those out from memory on a blank piece of paper. All right, so don't forget, don't push that off to the very last time you're studying for the exam coming up. So over the weekend, make sure you print out all the study guides for those chapters, get those figures going, and start working on the figures because they're easy points. Most people are very good visual learners. Not everybody, but most people are. And if you know you're a visual learner, then you should get 100% on those exam figures. And as a matter of fact, if you're really familiar with the exam figures, that will help you answer other tougher questions, multiple choice questions on the test. So please don't forget those. And that's pretty good. That's a good. Anybody have a question on the schedule at all? No. Okay, there might be a couple of people that still want to add this class. So let me just say real quick, the way that you find your way into this class is not by petitioning in lecture, but by petitioning in lab. Or if you're on the wait list, you don't have to petition. Just come the very first second that lab opens up, and I take roll call immediately and drop students that are no-shows immediately. So don't run to the bookstore to buy something and then come back and be like 5 minutes late to lab, because it will be all over for you, because a lot of students want to take this class. And I'm just really on time with adding and dropping people just to maximize student enrollment. All right, we can't wait around for 5 or 10 minutes to find out if somebody's really going to show up. We don't even have that time luxury to do that. Okay, so be in lab right at the particular time that it starts, which is 1 o'clock and 4:30, I believe. 4:30. Okay. All right, so I'm going to turn some lights down, like these two right here. Does that work for you guys? Too dark? I think that's probably okay. All right, so I'll put Mr. Clock away, and we're going to start the lecture. All right, chemical composition of the body, and that is chapter 2. I got to get my arrow options going here. Nice. All right, so we're actually going to talk about all this stuff. Atoms, which is the smallest particle that we're going to be interested in, because there's some very interesting electrical properties that atoms provide us. And as a matter of fact, every cell in your body acts like a battery, so we're interested in electrical charge. So we're going to go all the way back to atoms. Atoms can combine and associate with other atoms by chemical bonds, and those chemical bonds are a form of chemical energy. And if a bond is broken, that energy can be released and used for some other kind of purpose. And we're going to look and see how energy flows through your body. Acids and bases, the pH scale. pH scale is what? Just a measure of acidity. And then we've got 4 important, and it says organic molecules here. And indeed, they are organic molecules. But I would rather have you know these as important biological molecules, because there's all kinds of organic molecules that are highly toxic to life, right? So these are special, special biological molecules. That's why I went through the whole list. Okay, so let's start with something really small, atoms. And atoms are composed of a couple particles. There are protons, electrons, and neutrons. Let's start with neutrons. Neutrons have no electrical charge on them, so they are neutral. And protons, on the other hand, do have an electrical charge. They are positive, and electrons have a negative charge. The size of these particles is different, but the electrical charge, right, between a proton and an electron is exactly equal but opposite. So they exactly cancel each other out. All right. So, how are we going to think of an atom? For this class, I think it's okay to think of an atom with this solar system model right here, where there is some center particle and other particles whip around the center one in what we call orbitals. Right? The center piece right here is what we call the nucleus of the atom. And nucleus is used for a lot of different terms, right? Nucleus of the cell. What's another nucleus that you learned in anatomy? Nucleus. Oh, I'm sorry, I was talking at the same time you were. Go ahead. Ah, gray matter, exactly right. Right, if there's a bunch of gray matter deep inside the brain, that is a nucleus as well, right? A group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites deep in the central nervous system is a nucleus. All right, but in this particular case, we're talking about the center location inside an atom. And if this is a proton, okay, in order to make this a neutral atom, there should be one electron. And if you add a proton and electron together, then you get exactly no charge whatsoever. Okay, what makes the difference between one element and another, I see hydrogen here and carbon down over here, is the number of protons inside the nucleus. It's not determined by the electrons or neutrons. It's determined by the protons that are inside the nucleus. So if we have an atom with one proton in the nucleus, that's a hydrogen atom. By definition, that will never change. If there are six protons inside the nucleus, that is a carbon atom. Right? And for that six carbon atom, if we want to neutralize, have a neutral electrical charge, then there should be how many electrons floating around the nucleus? Yeah, if there's six protons, there should be six electrons as well. All right, and now you can kind of see the importance of some of these neutrons that are put into the nucleus, because what can you tell me about opposite charges? Opposite charges. They do attract each other. And what about the same charge? It's not that they ignore each other, but they actually hate each other, right? So here we have a bunch of positive charges inside the nucleus. All these protons want to get out of there because there's positive charge everywhere. The neutrons is just a special way to package all those protons together so they don't go flying out of the nucleus under most circumstances. Okay, so the number of neutrons really doesn't have anything to do with the element that we're looking at. It's just the number of protons. Okay, and so here we see some electrons winging around the nucleus. These things can be called orbitals or shells, and electrons fill these shells up in a particular order. This first shell right here can only have two electrons in it, and that's it. If another electron wants to join this atom, it has to go to the next outer shell, which I see right here. Right? And it is possible for this outer shell to have more than two electrons. Does anybody know how many electrons can be in this outer shell? Yeah, there can be eight, right? So this atom right here is actually looking for four more electrons someplace, right, to fill this outer shell out. And when it does, then this becomes a very stable atom, right? So atoms like to have either no electrons in the outermost shell or completely filled up. And the law is two in the first one, and then eight again. And that's just what we're going to consider in this class. All right, so the atomic number is the number of protons in the nucleus. And what did we say that determined? The atomic number determines what element it is, right? And the atomic mass is, for some atoms have neutrons. We want to add those neutrons together with the protons to figure out how heavy that particular atom is, right? And then we would use the atomic mass for that calculation. Okay. Electron shells or orbitals, first shell only two, second can have up to eight. Electrons in more distant shells have higher energy. Okay, that's not so important for this class. But this one is. Valence electrons. the valence electrons are the ones that are in the outermost shell. Right? And in that carbon, there were four. Those are what we call the valence electrons. And that outermost shell for carbon is looking for four more. So that carbon is very reactive. It has chemical reaction properties because of those valence electrons, right? That valence orbital. And so valence electrons can participate in chemical reactions to form bonds. And there's chemical energy in bonds. So an isotope, we don't get into isotopes in this class very much. An isotope is an atom that has the same number of protons, so it's the same element, but if you change the number of neutrons inside the nucleus, then the heaviness or the weight of that atom changes. So it is a different kind of thing, and we talk about that, right, in terms of it being an isotope. Some isotopes are stable and some are not. Like carbon-13 is pretty stable. There are other, and that's good enough for that. Okay, so isotopes contain different kinds or numbers of neutrons. Here is something that's not in your textbook. It's a chemistry chart, and I do want you to be familiar with this. I want you to know the first two columns, but not the third one. Third one is interesting to look at, but the first column gives us the word of a particular atom, like oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, all the way down the line to magnesium. But when we're writing equations out or even writing these compounds in a paragraph, we don't spell it out usually. We use the abbreviated chemical form of that atom. And so I want you to know all of these abbreviated symbols for these particular elements. And sometimes it's really easy, like magnesium is Mg, oxygen is O, carbon is C, hydrogen, H, nitrogen, N. It's really, really simple, okay? But then we got something like calcium and chlorine. They both start with a C, so they can't be C, right? And they can't be C also because what's carbon? Carbon is C, all right? So sometimes we have to employ a lowercase letter like capital C, little a for calcium, capital C, little L for chlorine. And that still sort of makes sense, but don't forget you can't use C for all of that. Then there's some even stranger kind of beasts, like sodium and potassium right here. If you look at their chemical symbol, you see sodium is Na, right? There's nothing about S in there at all because S is actually sulfur. Is sulfur on this list? Oh, I'm glad it is right there. Sulfur is S, right? And potassium starts with a P, but potassium can't be P because phosphorus is P. Right, and these come from the Greek nomenclature because sodium really is called natrium. And potassium, who knows what potassium is? I'm not sure I can remember. Kalium is potassium, right? So that's how these symbols evolve. All right, so what atom makes up most of your body? Okay, if we look at the third column, which you don't have to memorize, you see it's oxygen, right? And then carbon. We're a carbon-based life form. And then very, very small amounts of these other atoms. And then there's some even smaller amounts of what we call trace elements that are important to promote or allow certain kinds of chemical reactions to take place. You need just a very little of things like chromium and cobalt, but you do need to have some of these in your body to maintain homeostasis. Okay, so you got to memorize column one and column two. We're going to look at those. All right, chemical bonds. Chemical bond is an association between two atoms. And there's some rules to what happens there, and there are different kinds of chemical bonds as well. And I am going to talk about chemical bonds from the standpoint of a biological system. And let me first start by saying, defining something for you. Does anybody know what a solution is? What's a solution? I'm going to write this on the board. A solution, okay, like a cup of coffee, Coca-Cola, that kind of solution is what I mean. A solution has two parts to it, right? It's got the solvent molecule plus the, and somebody told me, thank you, the solute, because it was a long summer, and sometimes I forget that. Very good, solute. All right, so the solvent is the compound that is in the majority of a solution, right? And the solute is in the minority. It's a minority particle. in that particular solution. And so the solute could be a liquid or it could be a solid particle, right, that dissolves in the solvent. But the solvent in us, does anybody know what the solvent in us is? It is water. Okay, and probably everybody knows the chemical symbol for water. It is how many hydrogens? Two. We see it right there. How many oxygens? One, right? So we put these together in a special way and we get water. Okay. So, oh, I know what I was going to say. Different classes will talk about the strength of chemical bonds in different ways. And I'm going to talk about chemical bonds that make perfect sense if these chemicals are dissolved in water, right? If they're dissolved in some other kind of system or even dry, then these chemical bonds take different kinds of forms, okay? All right, so I'll go over that. I'll point that out as we go through things. Can I do this? Oh, that's not what I want. Oh, can I go back now? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, that's better. That's better. Okay, chemical bonds. If two atoms are joined together via chemical bond, then we call it a molecule. And it could be the same atom, could be different atoms. And the thing that allows that bond to form is determined by the valence electrons, right? Which is the electrons in what shell? The outermost shell. Okay? And the number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons that's needed to complete that association. Right? So if two electrons are being shared, that's a double bond. If one electron is being shared, that's a single bond. Okay. All right, so let's look at, in biology, the strongest kind of bond. The strongest kind of bond is a covalent bond. And remember, there is energy in the chemical energy in the form of this bond. All right, so for a covalent bond, that's what has the most energy compared to other kinds of bonds that we're going to look at. So here we have two atoms, and if you look at these two atoms, I just see one proton in each of these. And so that's a hydrogen. We talked about that one. And if there's one proton, how many electrons should be around that atom? There should be one, all right? And for that first orbital, what did we say was the maximum number for the first was two. And as a matter of fact, if that first orbital completely fills up with the electrons, that's a very stable configuration. And that's what all of these hydrogen ion atoms want to achieve. So this first atom right here is going to be looking around over the whole universe looking for another electron, and it can bump into another hydrogen atom. What does this other hydrogen atom want? Another electron. All right, so they form an association where they agree to share these two electrons, and in a sense, then both of these atoms have a feeling that there are two electrons in their valence shell, and that becomes a very stable kind of molecule. And it's illustrated over here. So I see two hydrogen atoms with two electrons. Sometimes these electrons are over here. Sometimes these electrons are over here. And they're being shared, so this is a covalent bond. That's pretty much a really important key term. How would you think about electrons in a covalent bond? They are shared between different atoms. And that's what we have right here, shared valence electrons. Okay. All right, so this is a hydrogen molecule, not a hydrogen atom, but a hydrogen molecule. Here is our solvent molecule. And I tell you what, let's build this thing. Let's build this thing. I don't have a periodic table here. I don't want to turn this slide. I have one in the computer. Anybody have a periodic table? You do have one? Good. You can just read something to me. All right. So let's build a water molecule to see how these electrons are shared. How's that? All right, so what do we got for water? Everybody knows. H2O, we got one oxygen. So here is, I'm going to put oxygen right here in the middle. Here's the nucleus. And what determines whether this is an oxygen atom or not? It is the atomic number. And what the heck was that atomic number once again? It's the number of protons inside the nucleus, right? So we know exactly how many protons are inside the nucleus of this oxygen atom. And there are 8 on that periodic table, so there are 8. Right on. All right, so can all 8 of these electrons fit in the first orbital? Here's the first orbital right here. Can they all 8 fit there? Absolutely not. Only 2 can fit in this outermost, the innermost orbital. And then if additional electrons are added to this atom, they have to go into the next highest orbital. And how many electrons are left? 6. Right? So here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, then 2 in the innermost. All right, so there's 6. How many electrons does this oxygen atom want to have to complete this this valence shell? I'll use that term. Yeah, it needs 2. Have you run into an atom that is also looking for 2 or maybe 1? We can find an atom that it will share 1 electron. We just need 2 of them to do that, and that is hydrogen. Right, so how would hydrogen associate with this? Here is the nucleus for hydrogen, and it's got 1 proton right here, and there's an orbital with 1 electron in that orbital. So here is an oxygen and a hydrogen sharing these 2 electrons. What kind of bond would we call that? That's a covalent bond, and we don't know a whole bunch about different kinds of bonds, but I did tell you, what is the strength of this bond? It's strong, right? And as a matter of fact, we're going to realize this to be the strongest kind of bond there is. Not true everywhere in the universe, but in us it is. All right, well, this oxygen is still missing an electron, but it can find another one from another hydrogen. So here is another hydrogen with 1 proton in the nucleus. Here's its orbital. It has an electron, so it's sharing those 2. This hydrogen atom over here is sharing these 2. Now, how many electrons are in the valence shell of this oxygen molecule when these covalent bonds form with 2 hydrogens? You got 8, right? And so that's a very nice stable configuration. All right, I'm going to go back one slide. Okay, for this particular molecule, and it's due to a property of the atoms that are participating in this chemical bond, these electrons sometimes are found over here on top, sometimes they're found over here on the bottom, sometimes in the side, sometimes in between them, over on the side over here, but they are in each of these locations the same amount of time, right? So they don't have a tendency to go to one side of the molecule or the other. They're just flying around all over the place, so it's just a nice cloud. There's no structure whatsoever when you look at these electrons flying around these 2 atoms. That's not so for the water molecule. It just so happens that this oxygen atom right here is very greedy with electrons. It wants to suck up the electrons that come from these hydrogen atoms. All right. So these electrons, right, the covalent ones, have a tendency to stay near the oxygen atom and not spend so much time by the nucleus of these hydrogen atoms. What's the electrical charge inside this nucleus right here? 1, I should probably write it down. 1 plus, and what about over here? 1 plus. So when all these electrons are on one side of the molecule, what kind of sense of electrical charge do you have on this end of the molecule? Right? It's going to be a little bit more positive because this proton is just kind of hanging out in space and it doesn't have these electrons floating around it. Okay, so this covalent bond is a little bit different than the one I'm showing on the screen. All right, so this one, the hydrogen molecule, is what we call a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons can be found anywhere with equal distribution in time around both of those nuclei. But the water molecule, because of oxygen, these electrons spend way more time near the oxygen molecule compared to the proton, the hydrogen molecules. So we see we have 10 protons on this molecule now, and we have 10 electrons. So if you're in the back of the room and you look at this molecule from really far away, what's the overall electrical charge? Got 10 protons, 10 electrons. What's the overall electrical charge? Yeah, it's going to neutralize. It's going to be zero, right? If you look at it from far away. But let's say that we're very, very small, and we can walk up onto this molecule from this direction, and in that particular case, it doesn't look like it's a neutral molecule. It's going to look like it's what kind of molecule? That it has a plus charge. Not a full plus charge, but some kind of plus charge. If you walk up to this molecule from this direction, okay, what does it look like? Some kind of plus charge, and because all these electrons are around the oxygen, if you walk up upon this molecule in this direction, what does it look like in terms of charge? It will have a negative charge, right? And if we add this little extra charge over here and up by the oxygen together, then it's completely neutral, right? So it has these little partial charges depending on what end of the molecule. And it just so happens when you have something that's different on one end compared to the other, right? Like the magnetic field on the Earth is positive on the top and negative on the bottom, we say it is polar, right? So a covalent bond like this is what we call a polar covalent bond because these electrons like to get stuck around oxygen. All right, so there are some atoms that we're going to look at that can form polar covalent bonds, and here is the list. It is oxygen, because that's what we're talking about. Okay, let's see if I can remember this list. Sulfur is an important one. Phosphorus is another important one. And there's one more that your book has a tendency to forget, and I'll remember what it is. Ah, nitrogen, I like that, good. All right, I think your book likes to forget about sulfur, but don't forget about sulfur. Okay, nitrogen. All right, so if there is hydrogen bound to either oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, or nitrogen, that's going to form a polar covalent bond. Now, you're probably wondering, why is that important? Well, you already told me. What about the same charge? Do they attract particles with the same charge? Do they attract or repel each other? Same charge, repel. If they have opposite charges, they attract each other. So now we have this little map of attraction, right? So what kind of molecule would want to attract itself to just this end of the water molecule? One that has a negative part to it, right? We'll want to get stuck over here. And what kind of molecule would want to associate close to the oxygen? Because this is negative, a positive charge, right? So where are you going to find a molecule? Let's go over here. So over here we said we need a negative molecule to associate with this one over here, right? Because that electrical charge isn't going away. Can you think of a molecule that has some kind of part to it that has a negative charge to it that would want to associate with this molecule? Look at this right here. Another water molecule. Right, so another water molecule wants to get stuck with this first one, but instead of a hydrogen being here, you would have an oxygen. Okay? Okay, a little bit different kind of bond, but that's the importance of water. Covalent bonds. We just actually built a water molecule that we see right here. Okay, and we see polar covalent bonds. Electrons are shared unequally between these atoms, and the different sides of the water molecule have a little bit different charge, right? And that charge can be used or is used to form different associations with other kinds of atoms or molecules that have electric charge on them. So here is the list, right? Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and don't forget sulfur as well. Okay, put that in there. Tend to form polar covalent bonds. And as a result, water is what we call a polar molecule. That's probably really important to write down. Because of these polar covalent bonds, we say water is a polar compound. Okay, as a polar compound. And polar compounds like to associate with other polar compounds. Polar compounds are completely uninterested in nonpolar compounds. And as a matter of fact, the nonpolar compounds like to huddle together or attract themselves and repel polar compounds. So in terms of these electrical properties, they're like two separate universes. There's a polar universe where there's polar compounds, and a nonpolar universe that contains nonpolar compounds. Okay. Right. You're going to have to think about that probably for the next couple weeks, but I'll be talking about it a lot. Let's go to another type of bond. Okay. An ionic bond in particular. And when we look at this atom, I see that there are 11 protons inside the nucleus and 12 neutrons inside the nucleus, right? And so this particular atom right here, because it has 11 protons, by definition has to be a sodium atom, right? Because the number of protons inside the nucleus determines what element it is, and we'll start working with a periodic table pretty soon. And on a test, I'll give you a periodic table. And if I ask you what is the atomic number of sodium, you can use that periodic table on the test to answer that question. All right, but the periodic table will have these symbols right here. So it's important for you to know Na, S, right, K. And you're going to see that that's really easy. All right, so we have a sodium atom. And how many electrons is it going to have in its orbitals? If it has 11 protons, it's going to have 11 electrons. So let's count them out. First orbital is 2, right? And then in the next one, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So we got 10 so far. There's one extra electron. That's got to go into the outermost shell, and here it is. Well, I never noticed that before, but that looks like a different color, huh? Okay. All right, so here is one lonely electron in this outermost shell. And remember, we would like to have either no electrons or 8 electrons in the valence shell. So what's easier, to find 7 more electrons or just to boot this one out? It's easier for this sodium atom to give up this electron. And when it does, what happens to it? There is no longer a complete balance between the number of protons in the nucleus and electrons, and it ends up being a little bit of, well, it's exactly one positive charge. So we have sodium with this plus sign right here. That means it's an ion. It has an electrical charge of exactly plus 1. All right. Well, we're interested in knowing where does this electron go. It just can't go anywhere. It's got to have a place to go before it leaves sodium. Let's look at a chlorine atom. Periodic table says there's 17 protons inside a chlorine atom, and we can count those out. First is 2, right, and then 8 in the next, which is 10. That means there's 7 electrons left over. Those 7 electrons go in the outermost shell. And to be stable, what does the chlorine atom want to do? Kick electrons out or just find one to put in the outermost shell? Just to add one, right? And when it bumps into a sodium, sodium wants to give one away, so that's very easy to accomplish. Sodium gives up an electron and chlorine accepts it. Now both chlorine and sodium are stable because their outermost valence shell is filled with electrons. All right, and then chlorine ends up with one extra electron, which means one extra negative charge. And what did you tell me about particles that have opposite charges? They attract each other, right? So there is an attraction between these two atoms because one is positive and the other is negative. That is a chemical bond, but we call that an ionic bond. And that's different than the covalent. What is a good way to think of covalent bond? Electrons are being shared with each other. In this case, they are not being shared. An electron is being transferred, right? So think transfer for ionic bond, not sharing. Okay. All right. We want to talk about ions a lot because we are very electrical beings and we need these ions inside our body, okay, to make everything work the way it should. So we need to develop a little bit of nomenclature so that when we talk about ions, we know exactly what we're talking about. So here we have a sodium, okay, and when we put it in water with chlorine, it turns into this kind of thing with one positive charge. And so we need to know what this kind of thing is. So because it has a positive charge, it is an electrolyte, right? Not L-I-G-H-T, but L-Y-T-E. It is also an ion. Ion pretty much means electrolyte. And it has electrical properties to it. If it has a positive charge, we call it a cation. And if it has one charge, we call it a mono. What does mono mean? One. A monovalent cation completely describes this ion or this electrolyte right here. All right, so I'll jot that down. Monovalent. And what did we say? Cation, if it's positive. All right, well, what was the other atom that we developed on this slide over here? We had one with a positive, one with a negative. What was the negative one? Chlorine. And it formed a nice ionic bond. So the chlorine is going to have just one charge, but it's going to be negative. So this is also monovalent because it has one charge, but it is opposite. So this is a monovalent anion. So anions are negative. All anions are negative. All cations are positive. And when I took organic chemistry, my organic chemistry teacher drew a figure on the board that I have never been able to forget. It's really hideous. But you'll never forget cation, right, if you draw this out. Should I show you or should I not, like, ruin the rest of your life? Okay, I'll draw it out. So here we have this. Okay, what am I drawing? Cat. And here we have a couple eyes. Okay, it looks like that. Oh, I forgot the mouth right there. A cation. Okay, so cations are positive. All right, not every ion has one charge. There can be ions, right, like magnesium, that have two charges. All right, so that's not monovalent. That could be divalent. And sometimes it runs around with bivalent. All right, divalent, bivalent mean exactly the same thing. Okay, so, and that doesn't describe it completely. What else would we have to put in this nomenclature to tell me exactly what magnesium is? It is divalent or bivalent, but what is it? It's a cation, right? So you can have divalent cations, divalent anions, and we'll talk about those things just in that sense. All right, so ionic bonds is when electrons are transferred. Covalent bonds are when electrons are shared, and which one is the strongest of those two? Covalent R. Okay, that's maybe not what you learn in chemistry, because in other situations, ionic bonds are way more strong compared to covalent. But for us, ionic are weaker than covalent bonds. Yeah, hi.
Sodium with monovalent can lose one electron, and magnesium is like
dive. Oh, magnesium, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dive can lose two.
Yeah. Okay, so we saw that in the outermost, I still have it on the slide right there. Okay, we see right here that sodium had, okay, one extra electron in the valence shell, right? If we look at magnesium, you could probably guess how many electrons are in its valence shell. Two. So magnesium is willing to give two electrons away to someplace. And as a result, then it becomes positive. And it can form ionic bonds because we know that there are atoms out there that have a negative charge to them, right, which will be attracted to this magnesium. And with just the atoms that we have on the board, we know that we can have a magnesium, which is a bivalent cation, and it will attract chlorine, which is a monovalent anion. But how many chlorines will magnesium attract? Two. MgCl2. And then this whole thing is a very nice, stable kind of compound. Okay, so that's just maybe a little visual way you could think of it. I'm going to work with periodic table sometime soon, as soon as I can close this slide off, and you'll see what's happening there. All right, remember that water molecule that was on the board that I erased? Remember, if you walk up on it from one direction, it looks like it has a different charge compared to the other direction. So what kind of compound is that called? That's called a polar compound, right? A polar compound. and I had solution and solvent on the board. Water is the solvent in our bodies. And all these other things that are in it, like ATP and sugar molecules, those are the solutes. And so we say that water is a polar solvent or a polar compound. What kind of molecules like to dissolve in a polar solvent? Other kinds of polar chemicals, right? So if anything has polarity, it will dissolve in water. If it doesn't dissolve in water, it is nonpolar. What could you tell me about fat and water? Oil and water, do they mix? They do not mix, right? And we said that water is a polar compound. Water doesn't mix with oil. You could probably tell me right now what kind of compound is oil.
Nonpolar.
Nonpolar, exactly right. And we're going to see why that is. It's because fats, just some basic fats, do not contain oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus. Okay? Compounds that have oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus, or can form polar bonds, those are the kind of compounds that can dissolve in water. All right, so, oh, look what we have right here. We've got now a combination of sodium, which is a monovalent cation, and chlorine, monovalent anion, and we put it in water, and I see a bunch of water molecules. Do you see some water molecules right here? I think you know enough about that graphic, right? All right, so sodium is a cation, so what end of the water molecule is going to want to associate with sodium? The oxygen end, right? And so it forms, when sodium is put in, or the sodium cation is put in water, it's going to form these hydration shells around them so that the negative part of water can neutralize this positive part of sodium. And then here we have the, okay, here we have some positive part of this water, so another water molecule is going to want to associate with this other positive part of the innermost water molecule, and it's going to keep forming these hydration shells. Now, what about chlorine? Can chlorine dissolve in water? Well, chlorine is an anion, right? So it has charge. Right? And does water have any? What's going to associate with chlorine? A positive charge or a negative charge? Positive, right? Because positives attract. And does water have any positive part to it in terms of electrical properties? Yeah, the hydrogens have a positive area, so the hydrogens of water will want to form hydration shells around this chlorine. So both the sodium ion and the chlorine ion will dissolve in water very easily because water is a polar compound. Does anybody know in your everyday life where you can find sodium chloride? Yeah, that's just table salt. So if you take table salt and put it in a glass of water, are you familiar that it will dissolve? You can pour a lot of salt in water, right? Because all these water molecules will accept it very nicely, and these hydration shells will form, and then it will be dissolved in that particular solvent. Now, what could we put in that water? Well, we could put a drop of oil, and it won't dissolve because it is nonpolar, okay? Let me just take a quick look at this. All right, ionic bonds are weaker than covalent. Yep, this is true. Okay. All right, so based on polarity, we can have molecules that are hydrophilic. Philic means love, right? And hydro means water. So some molecules have a love of water. Some are hydrophobic. And that just means a fear of water, but basically it just means it doesn't want to have anything to do with water. All right, so what kind of compound is hydrophilic? What kind of compound is water? Did we say water was? It is polar, right? So what kind of compound is hydrophilic? It's going to be another polar compound, or one that has an electronic charge on it. Right? Hydrophilic molecules are soluble in water, right, because they are polar compounds, right? And they readily form hydration spheres. Glucose and amino acids are a really good example of hydrophilic compounds. And maybe we could take another step, another leap right here, easy for me to do, but really difficult for you, unless you've studied this chapter a lot already, all right? So what kinds of atoms does glucose and amino acids have to make them polar or hydrophilic. I gave you four atoms. Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur. All right, they got to have some of those atoms incorporated into themselves so that they can become hydrophilic. And that will just stand out, and you'll notice that right away. Hydrophobic molecules are nonpolar, cannot form hydration spheres, so they don't want to have anything to do with a water solvent. And so these things would be like oils. Do oils typically have a lot of oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, or phosphorus that make up the molecule? No, they don't. And maybe some of you might know, what is the majority atom in organic compounds? Oh, I'm sorry. In nonpolar compounds, it is carbon. Okay, and when carbon forms certain kinds of bonds, we call that an organic compound. Organic compounds typically are nonpolar and hydrophobic as a result of that. Okay, so we got two kinds of bonds, polar and ionic. Which one's the strongest? Covalent is the strongest. A little bit weaker is ionic. Here is a third kind, and I want you to know the strength of four kinds of bonds. But here's the third one. All right, and here's that nice, familiar water molecule, right? And there's an oxygen bound to a hydrogen. That forms what kind of covalent bond? A polar covalent bond, right? Here's a polar covalent bond. So this hydrogen is a little bit positive. This oxygen is a little bit negative. It's going to attract different ends of a water molecule. So the oxygen will attract a hydrogen from a neighboring water molecule. And then this one over here, the hydrogen of this one will attract another water molecule, but the oxygen end. So there is a bond between these water molecules, and it's relatively weak to very weak. We call that a hydrogen bond. So hydrogen bonds are almost the weakest kind of bond that we're going to look at. All right, so water, even when it's a liquid, has this structure to it. And whenever you see a bunch of molecules put together and it has a highly ordered structure, you like to think of it as a crystal, something that's hard. Well, we know when water is a liquid, it's a liquid, but it has this structure to it. It's a crystal. That's pretty confusing. So people came up with a term called liquid crystal. There are some compounds that are liquid crystals that have some properties of both of those. Okay, and because water has these hydrogen bonds, it produces something called surface tension. And the water molecules are sticky, right, because it can form these hydrogen bonds. Some animals can even walk right on the surface of water because they're not heavy enough to break all of these hydrogen bonds on the surface of water, right, and that's what we call surface tension. All those bonds on the surface of water is surface tension. Has anybody ever seen an animal walk on water? Like, give me an example. I should put a little movie in here. Like a little water bug. Okay? They'll never sink. And you can actually see them, okay, just walking right on the water because water has surface tension because of this property right here, because of the hydrogen bonds. That's useful in your body in a number of ways, and it's going to be very harmful in other parts of your body, and we're going to discuss all those different conditions. Okay, why hydrogen bonds are good and why they're bad and why they even have to be defeated in some parts of your body completely. All right, there is the weakest kind of bond that your book doesn't talk about very much. Close your eyes. I just want to scale through a bunch of these slides over here. Maybe I can find it. Maybe I can't. It's coming up right here. Okay. So here I have a protein, a big long chain of amino acids, and I see an oxygen, right? And so what kind of bond is an oxygen? What can it form? Polar kinds. What about nitrogen? Polar kinds of bonds. And so here oxygen is negative, nitrogen is positive. This is a nice ionic bond. That's what? Not the strongest kind, but pretty strong. Here is a bond between two sulfur atoms. And this line right here signifies that these two sulfur atoms are sharing one pair of electrons. So what kind of bond is this if these electrons are being shared between these two sulfur molecules? Covalent, right? So this protein is being stabilized by very strong bonds between amino acids that can form a covalent bond. It's also stabilized by ionic bonds, right, but not to the same degree. There can even be hydrogen bonds. These are really weak, but it's going to help make this protein attain a certain kind of shape, or what we call configuration. And then here is the third kind, and I've had in the past many students miss it, so I want to talk about it right now. This is called a van der Waals force. Van der Waals force is, you should consider that as a chemical bond between nonpolar compounds or organic compounds. Right, so all of these that we looked at so far are polar. These rings just symbolize carbon atoms. Carbon atoms cannot form covalent bonds. Which are the atoms that can form covalent bonds? Oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus. Carbon is not in that list, right? So carbon forms nonpolar covalent bonds, but if two molecules that are nonpolar bump into each other, they will associate with each other, and that produces a van der Waals force. And that is by far the weakest force. So there are four kinds of bonds. And in order of strength, we have covalent the strongest, ionic not so strong, hydrogen pretty weak, van der Waals forces even weaker than that. Okay? Okay. Close your eyes. I'm going to scroll back one more time. All right. We're talking about pH. Acids, bases, and the pH scale. You've probably heard of acids and bases before, but let's define what an acid and a base is. And here is a list of some. Some are important in your bodies. Some of these right here are not. But an acid is some kind of compound that can release hydrogen ions into solution, and in particular a water solution. All right, so what's another way that we could think of a hydrogen ion? As a matter of fact, what kind of ion is a hydrogen ion? It is monovalent cation, right? How did it get to be a monovalent cation? Because there's one proton in the nucleus, one electron in its outermost shell, and if it boots that one electron out, what's left? One proton, right, which is a hydrogen ion, which is a monovalent cation. And so sometimes we just call that a proton because it's just a proton, right? There's no electron floating around it. So a hydrogen ion or a proton, exactly the same thing. A compound that releases that into a solution is what we call an acid, right? So a base does the opposite, right? It can absorb or attract hydrogen ions, right, that are in solution and incorporate them into the molecule. So then that hydrogen ion leaves, or that proton leaves the solution, and the hydrogen ion concentration of that solution decreases. So an acid is what we call a proton donor, and a base is a proton acceptor. And you can see that if you have a donor and acceptor together, right, they will like to associate with each other. And I think probably you all know that. If you have an acid, what can you use to neutralize an acid? A base, right? Because one is a proton donor, one is a proton acceptor. That's a very easy agreement to enter into, right? Here are some examples of acids. Hydrochloric acid, this is a very strong acid. When you put it in water, it completely breaks down into chlorine, which has a chlorine ion, which is going to have what kind of electrical charge? Yeah, just it's a monovalent anion. And this proton right here, and that's going to be the hydrogen ion or another monovalent cation, right? Put them together, then this molecule becomes neutral electrically. The one that we're going to be most interested in this class is carbonic acid, way down over here, carbonic acid. It can actually release two protons into solution, but that doesn't make it a stronger acid than hydrochloric acid. It's weaker, but anyway, this is still an acid. There is a compound that can come from water. It's called a hydroxyl ion, and I see it right here, this OH. Maybe as a homework assignment, you can take a water molecule and rip off one of the protons on it and leave its electron and figure out what kind of charge is left over. So remember, a proton is a positive one charge. If you remove that from water, then the OH is going to have a negative charge to it. Right. And then here's a sodium. If we think of a sodium ion, it has a positive charge, so that OH and the sodium will form a covalent bond. Put sodium hydroxide in water, it dissociates right into this hydroxyl ion. And that can accept electrons to become water once again. So this is a base. This is a strong base. And we're not going to be really interested in any of these bases. We will be interested in carbonic acid. I'm not going to ask you this on the first test, the chemical formula for carbonic acid, but if you have an easy time remembering the shapes of molecules or the atoms that participate, okay, if you can write this chemical compound down in this form and know it's carbonic acid, that would be helpful for you later on in the class. Okay, pH. This is why you need a calculator, non-graphing scientific calculator in this class. I want you to become really familiar with pH. It's kind of strange. pH is a scale that goes from 0 to 14, and it's a measure of acidity. That's the best way of thinking about it. It's a measure of acidity of that particular water solution. Right? So pH stands for, there's a certain equation that the hydrogen ion concentration has to be put into to develop that number. So 0 means it's highly acidic. There are a lot of protons in solution. 14 is all the way on the opposite end. It means there's hardly any protons in solutions, but a lot of hydroxide anions instead. And what's the number right smack in the middle? 7. We say 7 is neutral because there is an exactly equal number of protons and hydroxyl ions in solution, and they cancel each other out perfectly. To calculate pH, you have this equation. You'll get this equation on the test, so you don't have to memorize this. All right, so how do we calculate pH? Well, we have to know what the concentration of hydrogen ion is in solution, okay, and that's symbolized by this bracket. When you see a chemical compound with a bracket on it, it means that's a concentration of this particular compound. Like moles per liter or particles per liter tells us what the concentration is. I could calculate the concentration of people in here by counting all the people, figuring out how much air it is, right, and then we could figure out what the concentration is. Same thing for hydrogen ions. We can use that to calculate pH. All right, so purely neutral solution is 7. Acids have a pH less than 7. So from 0 to 7 is acidic. And the smaller the number gets, the more acidic it is. All right, so that's the strange thing about pH. And I think I'm just going to do a little dance right now because it's strange. Okay, what can you tell me about pH as the hydrogen ion concentration increases? As hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to pH? It goes down. Okay, as hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to acidity? As hydrogen ion concentration increases, acidity goes up. So here's the connection I want you to make. As acidity goes up, what about pH? It goes down. All right, we call that an inverse relationship. And mathematically, it's really handy to have that relationship, but the first time you think about it or see it, it just seems like, why make it so complicated? Because it really makes a lot of other things really simple. Okay? Okay. So to calculate pH, I have a couple problems for you to solve, maybe back of the chapter in the exam study guide. You'll be given a concentration of hydrogen ions, and then you operate on it with this equation right here, and out comes pH. I will also give you the pH of something, and you'll have to calculate what the hydrogen ion concentration is. All right? And every calculator is a little bit different how you use this log function. And this log function is what, LOG, and maybe you could put the little tiny 10 right here, which is different than LN, which is a log, but it's a different kind of log algorithm, right? So you want log to the base 10 for this particular equation, right? And as you see, as we increase the hydrogen ion concentration, okay, the pH number is going to go down. If you ever see an equation with something in the denominator, like we see right here, equal to something that's in the numerator over here, that means that there is an inverse relationship. If this goes up, right, then this number gets smaller, so this thing over here has to get smaller. If these two parameters are in the numerator, right? If this part in the numerator gets bigger, what happens to this over here? It has to get bigger as well. We call that a direct relationship. pH has an inverse relationship with hydrogen concentration. That's why they go in opposite directions. Right, so 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, smaller numbers, but more hydrogen ions in solution. Okay. If we plot a bunch of numbers out, we have a couple columns. Here's the concentration of hydrogen ions in solution, right, just a molar concentration. Which one of these is the smallest concentration of hydrogen ions? Let's see if you can understand scientific notation. Here's a 1. Here's a 1, but there's a decimal in front of it, right? So this is a lot smaller, right? A factor of 10, right? There's a 10 times difference. What about this number down over here, 0.01? It's 100 times different compared to the first one, right? 100 times smaller, and all the way down the list to where we get 10 to the minus 14th. You would have to have 14 zeros behind that decimal point, so that's a very, very small concentration. All right, so here is the highest concentration of acid. Here is the least concentration of acid. What number do you see right smack in the middle? 10 to the minus 7, right? 10 to the minus 7, and guess what that number minus 7 means? pH of 7. If you put it into that equation, that's the number that will jump out at you, okay? All right, and as you become more acidic, okay, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration? It goes up, but what happens to the pH number that we see in the second column? It goes 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It decreases, right? So you'll have to be familiar with that. The hydroxyl concentration goes the opposite way compared to hydrogen ion, but pH is a measure of acidity, and that's what I want you to know. And your body operates under a very small range of pH, surprisingly small. Mostly, our pH in the blood is 7.35. So are we exactly neutral? No. What are we inside if we're 7.35? Acidic or basic? Slightly basic. I like that. We're basic, okay? And so 7.35, just kind of jot that number down, 7.35, if all of a sudden your body changed to 7.2, maybe even 7.25, that would be lethal. Does that difference between 7.35 and 7.25 seem like a big difference or a little difference? It seems like a little difference to me. So a little difference in pH can cause major changes in your physiology. So that's why we are so interested in pH. And in order to maintain homeostasis, that pH should be maintained within what? A narrow range to support life. It can go up, it can go down, but it can't go up and down very much. Right? So there are things in our body that prevent large changes in pH. They are called buffers. A buffer is a compound, when placed in water, resists a change in pH when you put an acid in that solution or a base. It doesn't matter. Whenever you add an acid or a base to solution, if it has a buffer, then the pH won't change. Okay. A buffer doesn't mean that it will keep the pH at exactly 7. There are certain buffers that can maintain a pH much higher than that, like 8 or 9, and there are buffers that can maintain a pH much lower than that. Right? And in our body, these buffers maintain a pH of 7.35, but not exactly 7. Here is one of the most important buffer systems in our body. It's called the bicarbonate buffer system. We have it in blood, and we have it in a bunch of places. When do we stop class today? 45? 12:45? Okay, good. The bicarbonate buffer system. All right, you know this one right here. What is this molecule? That's water. Anybody ever bump into CO2 before? And what is that? One carbon, and how many oxygens? Two or carbon dioxide. All right, these are important biological molecules. Neither of these are organic, however. All right, so this is a solvent in our body, but you're going to see that water is not only the solvent, it's a very important participant in many chemical reactions. It's a reactant. or product in many reactions inside our body. CO2 is a product, and CO2 is toxic to us if it builds up in concentration. It's a byproduct of producing ATP. Who knows something about ATP? What's ATP? Yeah, it's the form of energy in our body that can be most easily used to do other kinds of things, like muscle contraction or develop nerve impulses. In order to make ATP, one very efficient system produces carbon dioxide as a byproduct, right? So you get ATP, which is what you want, and also CO2, which is what you don't want. And how do we get rid of CO2 in our bodies, typically? By exhaling, okay? And in order for mitochondria to make ATP, they have to produce CO2, but they also need to have oxygen available to them. All right, so that's the reason why we breathe. We inhale to bring in oxygen. We exhale to get rid of CO2. Okay. So let's take a look at the CO2 molecule. One, it dissolves in water, and CO2 can dissolve in water pretty easily. Not all compounds can. It forms this compound right here, H2CO3, and that's what we call carbonic acid, right? And it's not a very strong acid, but it's really important in our body. Furthermore, carbonic acid can break down into hydrogen ion, or what's another name for this hydrogen ion right here? What's inside the nucleus? That's a proton, so people use hydrogen ion and proton synonymously. So carbonic acid breaks down into a proton and HCO3. This is bicarbonate. Right? And what did we call a compound that can donate a hydrogen ion or a proton to solution? An acid. That's why we call this carbonic acid. Right, so when our body produces CO2, it also produces carbonic acid, which can produce hydrogen ions. But if your body produces hydrogen ions, right, it can bump into this bicarbonate, form carbonic acid and produce water and CO2. So when we put hydrogen ions in our body, right, this bicarbonate right here is a buffer. It takes these protons out of solution and it just makes water and CO2 out of it. And these arrows, do you see these arrows going in one direction or bidirectional? Bidirectional. So this chemical reaction can go to the right or it can go to the left, and it all depends on the concentration of these compounds. Right, so it can easily go back and forth. There's no big change in energy. And an enzyme helps this process, and that enzyme is called carbonic anhydrase. It speeds up this reaction. There is a law in chemistry that says when we add bicarbonate, not bicarbonate, but any kind of chemical to the right-hand side of an equation, and if it's double arrow like this, if we add something over here, it will have a tendency to force the reaction to the left. Right? If we add something on the left, it's going to have a tendency to force the reaction to the right. Right? And so we call that Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. And a lot of things are in equilibrium in our body because of that. Right, so if we add bicarbonate, which way does it go? To the left. If we add CO2, which way does it go? To the right. All right, let's make it a little bit more complicated. Let's take away bicarbonate. Which way is this reaction going to go? All right, then these things over here are have a tendency to replenish that bicarbonate that was taken away. Right, so if we add bicarbonate, it's going to force the direction to the left. If we remove bicarbonate, it's going to force the reaction to the right, and that happens because of these double-ended arrows. And an enzyme that makes that very easy to happen, and that's called carbonic anhydrase. pH of blood normally is about 7.35, and maybe a little bit more basic than that, 7.45. It's maintained by buffers, like that bicarbonate buffer. An acidosis is a condition in your body where the pH goes below 7.35. And alkalosis occurs in your body when pH is greater than 7.45. So that's a very narrow range, a pH unit of 0.1, right, is a normal pH in a person's body. Somebody that's diabetic could have a pH of maybe 7.2, and you can see what? That's out of that normal range. If you went to 7.2 right now, that would be lethal. But if that condition develops over a period of time, there are other compensatory mechanisms that will keep you alive, right? So you can't change instantaneously to that degree, but over a period of time you can. Nonetheless, that's not a healthy condition to be in, okay? Okay, organic molecules. We're going to put some things together. Organic molecules are those that contain a carbon atom, okay? It's got to have a carbon, and it has to have a covalent bond to a hydrogen. All right, so we have a carbon covalently bond to a hydrogen. We saw a bunch of pretty strange molecules that form these polar covalent bonds with hydrogen if they were what atom? Polar covalent bonds happen because of nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, oxygen. All right, and here we have carbon. Does carbon form a carbon-hydrogen bond? Does that form a polar covalent bond? No, it does not, because it's not phosphorus, sulfur, what else? Oxygen, nitrogen, okay? All right, so these compounds, these organic compounds that only have carbon and hydrogen, right, are nonpolar. So do they want to dissolve in water? They cannot, because water is polar. So these compounds that are made exclusively of carbon and hydrogen are what we call hydrophobic, because they are nonpolar. Carbon has four electrons in the outer shell, right? And it bonds with other atoms covalently to fill that outermost shell so that it comes up to 8 electrons. So carbon is looking for 4 more electrons to put in that valence shell. And here is what can happen. Right, here we have a carbon. And here is a proton that can share one electron. Here's a hydrogen atom that can share one electron. Here's another one that can share one electron. These are all single bonds. And it just so happens then that there are two carbons next to each other and they can share a pair of electrons. So we have these four covalent bonds around this one carbon atom. And exactly the same situation here. And the exact same situation here and here and here all the way down the line. This is a compound that we call hexane. And since it has a carbon covalently bond to hydrogen, is that an organic compound? All right, organic molecule contains carbon covalently bond to hydrogen. And here we have an organic compound. And do you see sulfur, nitrogen, phosphorus, or oxygen? No polar covalent bond, so this thing is a hydrophobic molecule, will not dissolve in water whatsoever. Okay, what can happen to this nice straight chain is that it can bend upon itself like this. It can bend back and form this cyclic structure right here, this ring structure, and we just call that cyclohexane, and sometimes a single bond can double up and become a double bond. And then it has the same number of carbons but less hydrogens because of these double bonds, and then this compound has to have a different name. We call that benzene. So these are important organic compounds, but they are not important biological compounds, right? So just because something's organic doesn't mean that it's important biologically. This carbon chain right here is useful because other kinds of things can be substituted into these positions where we see hydrogen atoms, right? And those different kinds of compounds we call a functional group. So if we remove this hydrogen and stick a phosphorus where this hydrogen is, okay, what are we doing to the molecule in terms of shape? We're changing the shape, which means what? Changing the function of that molecule. And as a matter of fact, in this particular case, in a really big way, it's changing from a completely hydrophobic compound to one that can be partly hydrophilic. So part of the molecule can be in water and the other part in lipid. It has characteristics of both. So that's pretty interesting. So functional groups definitely change the function of these carbon backbones. All right, so let's look at some of these functional groups. If we have a carbon in the middle of a hydrocarbon chain, double bond to an oxygen, right, we call that a carbonyl group, a carbonyl group. And if we change the functional group, this carbonyl group, to an OH, can you see there's a difference right there? Okay, we don't call that a carbonyl group, we call that a hydroxyl group. And if we switch out oxygen for sulfur, right, we call that a sulfhydryl group. So now we see that benzene, which is organic but hydrophobic, can be changed into a hydrophilic molecule by putting what? Oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur. Here's a nitrogen. This nitrogen group is going to be called an amino group. And you're familiar with the building block of proteins, probably. What is, you know, anybody know what the building block of a protein is? Amino acid. And here we see something where the functional group is what we call an amino group. So guess what an amino acid has? It has this nitrogen on it someplace. We're going to look at the structure in a little bit, right? So it has this nitrogen, so it's going to make perfect sense when we get there. It's an acid, so what else can it do? It can donate a proton into solution, okay, an amino acid. So amino acid comes from this amino group right here. Carboxyl group has this look to it. It's always at the terminus of a molecule. And so it's a double bonded oxygen to this hydroxyl group, a little bit more complicated. This is what we call a carbonyl group. When you see something like this, it's going to be an acid. So a carbonyl group gives acidity to this molecule. Here's phosphate. Here's a phosphate group. If we look at phosphorus with four oxygens, sometimes we just call that PO4H2. We call that inorganic phosphate because phosphate by itself would just be P, but if you put all these oxygens around it, we call that inorganic phosphate. And again, these protons here can be released, and then this thing here becomes an acid as a result. This proton can be released to solution. So a carboxyl group is an acidic group because an acid donates protons to solution. Right. Some compounds that you're familiar with that have carboxyl groups, okay, would be like lactic acid, acetic acid. Probably you've never looked at lactic acid, but you know that it's a byproduct of strenuous exercise, right? It's produced. All right, so let me jot this down on the board. Let me give you a quick quiz. All right, so what's the secret excretory product that we have to get rid of when mitochondria make ATP for us? We looked at it already. Yeah, carbon dioxide. So here is CO2. All right, CO2, is that an organic compound? What does an organic compound have to have? A C sharing electrons with an H. Do you see an H right here? No. This is not an organic compound. But is that an important biological compound in your body? Yes. So organic and biological are not exactly the same. Okay. Okay. Basically wanted to show you there. Carbohydrates. This is the first kind of major biological molecule we're going to look at. There are four. Carbohydrate is one, and proteins are one, lipids are another one, and nucleic acids. Nucleic acids make DNA or our genetic material inside our body, and we're going to break these chemical compounds down. So can you remember anything about benzene? What did we have in benzene? We had just carbons and hydrogens, right? And we said we could change benzene into other kinds of molecules by substituting other functional groups for those hydrogens along that carbon backbone. And here we have a molecule which is that exact same carbon backbone. And look, a hydrogen ion has, or hydrogen atom has been replaced with a hydroxyl group. And not just in one location, but in a couple locations. As a matter of fact, every carbon has a hydroxyl group bound to it. Okay, and except for this terminus right here. So this thing, because of all these oxygens, turns this molecule in from a hydrophilic molecule into a hydrophobic molecule into hydrophilic, right? Benzene was hydrophobic. This one here, because of all these polar covalent bonds, is hydrophilic. This thing will like to dissolve in water. If we look at this carbon and the functional groups on either side of it, what do we have? A hydrogen, oxygen, and another hydrogen. So, how many hydrogens do we see right here? Two. How many oxygens? Have you ever bumped into anything with two hydrogens and one oxygen? Water, H2O, right? H2O. So when people first were investigating these kinds of compounds, they always found that there was exactly one water molecule for every carbon that was in the water molecule. And so what makes up this backbone right here? Carbon, right? And so that's how it got its name. It's really called a carbon hydrate, but we call it a carbohydrate instead. Right? So the other thing that you should know about a carbohydrate is that it's a sugar. Okay, so carbohydrates are sugars. This is a sugar right here. And I want you to be able to recognize this as a sugar molecule. Sugar molecules can even form these cyclic structures. This particular one is glucose. How many carbons does glucose have? This probably is pretty important. It's got six, right? Okay, or when we get into respiration, that will be important. Here is another kind of sugar. This is fructose, right? It has the same amount of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens, but it's just in a little bit different location, a little bit different structure. Okay, so you can surmise that the function of these two different sugars is going to be a little bit different because of that difference in structure. Forms a little bit different kind of cyclic structure. When you look at this, I want you to be able to tell me it's a sugar molecule, right? Because you got what? Carbon hydrates right here. I don't want you to be able to tell me that this is glucose and this is fructose down here, but I do want you to be able to recognize that these are both sugars, including the one that's in the middle, galactose. I see six carbons, and then I see there's a water molecule on either end of that carbon. So this is what a carbon hydrate or a carbohydrate. These are all sugars. And a glucose all by itself is what we call a monosaccharide. Mono means one. If we put two glucoses together, join them with a covalent bond, it becomes a disaccharide. If we put thousands of glucose molecules together, okay, that becomes a polysaccharide. Okay. All right, and so glucose, fructose, and galactose are all simple sugars because they're just monosaccharides. Here are some examples of disaccharides that are pretty important. Remember, there's two simple sugars that are joined together. Sucrose, table sugar, right, is one glucose and one fructose. And does sucrose dissolve in water? If you put table sugar in water, coffee, tea, does it dissolve in? Yeah. Okay, what atom in sucrose allows it to dissolve in water? What's allowing that to happen? What atoms are necessary? Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur. Yeah, oxygen. And where does it have oxygen? All over the place, right? So sugars are very easily dissolved in water. Here's lactose, that's a disaccharide. It's one glucose and one galactose. So galactose sometimes is called a milk sugar. Maltose is just two glucoses put together. We might run into some of these disaccharides later in class, but maybe a couple of them. Polysaccharides, many glucoses put together. If we put many glucoses together, we get something called starch. It could have thousands of glucose molecules joined together. Where do we find starch? Plants or animals? Plants, like potatoes, wheat, corn, loaded with starch. All right, so when you eat a potato, what kind of compound are you eating? Are you eating a lipid, a protein, a nucleic acid, or a carbohydrate? And a carbohydrate is a sugar. Right, so when you eat a potato, that's sugar. Do you know anybody that might have problems with regulating blood sugar levels all the time? That's called diabetes, right? So potatoes can be potentially pretty dangerous because they're just a sugar cube sitting there, but in this case, all just glucose, right? No sucrose whatsoever. Glycogen is very much like starch, but it's the kind of sugar molecule or polysaccharide that animals produce. And it is just made out of glucose, but it has a little bit different branching pattern to it. So it has a little bit different structure. All right, so starch and glucose are all polymers of glucose. There's no other kind of sugar in there. And glucose is an important energy molecule, so starch and glycogen are very important energy reservoirs for plants and animals, right? Glycogen for us. And so it allows organisms to store, this is a pretty important statement, but it will be a couple weeks before you really appreciate it, right? It allows organisms to store thousands of molecules of glucose in one molecule, one polysaccharide. And that has an important physical chemistry property, and it is it drastically reduces osmotic problems. Right? That's the reason why glucose all by itself can't be stored inside of a cell. It has to be stored as a single molecule. Otherwise, the cell is going to explode. And we're going to see why that happens. Right? So you need glycogen inside of a cell instead of thousands of glucoses, because otherwise these cells will explode. And in this case, I'm not actually exaggerating. Okay, sometimes I exaggerate. Like, when did I exaggerate the last lecture? When somebody gets hyperthermic and it's a positive feedback mechanism, their temperature goes up and goes up and goes up and goes up. And what did I say? They eventually blow up in a big ball of flames, explode in a big, that doesn't happen, right? Okay. All right, so when we get back, we're going to see how to make these covalent bonds between monosaccharides to form a polysaccharide.